Fears about the role of money in politics are nothing new. In 1907, President Theodore Roosevelt signed the Tillman Act to limit corporate donations to campaigns. Today, things are different, as people like Mitt Romney and Jack Welch argue that corporations are people. The Supreme Court has opened the door to more money in politics, and the inequality that Teddy Roosevelt fought has made a significant comeback. Politico journalist Kenneth Vogel looks into the role that money is playing in today's politics in his new book called Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and a Pimp on the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. It's published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased it has brought Kenneth Vogel to our show today. Hello.
Hey, great to be with you.
By big money, do you mean the whole range of costs in political campaigns, or do you mean something more specific?
I mean the outside spending that was cleared by Citizens United, the Supreme Court's 2010 decision, as well as a subsequent lower court decision. And what that allowed is for unlimited political spending independent from the campaigns. And so we're talking about super PACs and some of these nonprofit groups, not donations directly to the candidates, which of course also have spiraled in recent years. But this is a different type of giving that has really empowered these individual donors more than the parties or the candidates.
Well, if I am a rich donor and I give money to a super PAC, hoping that somehow that's going to influence the politician, how does the politician know that I gave so much money?
Well, the super PAC has actual public disclosure requirements, and so the politician would be made very much aware of it. However, I think what you're hitting at is this idea of independence, and it's one of the things that the Supreme Court actually held up as a reason to justify this new type of spending that they were now legalizing in Citizens United. And they said that as long as it's separate from the candidate, then it won't put the candidate in a position where they are indebted to the giver. And of course, with super PACs in particular, it's a very thin and sometimes non-existent line between the super PAC and the candidate and the candidate's campaign. And so they are very much aware of it. There are other types of giving, however, that are in fact secret and that a candidate might have more difficulty becoming aware of who was funding.
And then there are the very public things like politicians going to Sheldon Adelson and wooing him.
Yeah, that's right. And this is the what would have seemed to have been the absurd end of this process, that it occurred very quickly from the 2010 Supreme Court decision until now, where you have these individual donors, sometimes groups, sometimes just single donors like Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas casino mogul who you reference, who suddenly become the new kings of politics. And they do they are courted heavily by both individual politicians and operatives who seek their favor because they know that a single check from one of these politicians up to $20 million, which is what Sheldon Adelson spent keeping Newt Gingrich's woebegone primary campaign in 2012 for the Republican presidential nomination alive, can dramatically alter the landscape.
Although it didn't buy Newt Gingrich very many votes, so it doesn't always work. This fear that somebody can actually buy an election doesn't always pan out.
That's true. In many cases, in fact, what I write about in the book is there is a backlash. Some of the giving is so ham-handed and so divorced from the realities of what voters are thinking about or what political operatives know to be effective that it in some ways has the reverse effect, which is what happened with Sheldon Adelson's giving. Not only did it not elect Newt Gingrich as the Republican nominee or as president, but in fact, you could make the case that it really hurt Mitt Romney. It hurt Sheldon Adelson's ultimate goal of defeating Barack Obama.
Now, why would he want to defeat Barack Obama other than the fact of his ideology? Because his big thing is that he doesn't want online gambling on the internet. It's competition to him in Las Vegas. That doesn't seem to be a major issue in American politics.
Well, not because he's not trying to make it one, which in fact he is. But I take your point. In fact, his giving, like that of a lot—
I mean, it's not the same thing as being in the oil business like some other people.
Exactly. You're referencing the Koch brothers, and they are ones who maybe there is something of a clearer line between their huge giving and the types of policies that they would like to see enacted and their bottom lines. With Sheldon Adelson, that's not at all the case. He's doing extremely well under Barack Obama's presidency. His net worth has gone from like $4 billion to upwards of $40 billion during Barack Obama's presidency. So there is no real argument to be made that he is in some way seeking policies that would better serve his bottom line from his big giving in the presidential election, at least in 2012. Now, he may end up spending a lot of money in subsequent elections on this internet gambling issue, but his giving in 2012 seemed almost exclusively driven by ideology on a single issue, Israel, that doesn't, and the defense of Israel, that doesn't really affect his bottom line in any way, shape, or form.
But Harry Reid came to his defense mainly because they're from the same state.
Yeah, and in fact, he has been giving for years sort of across party lines in ways that he was not going after Harry Reid. And in fact, it'll be interesting because in 2016, Harry Reid will be up for re-election. Harry Reid has gone after these big donors on the right. You'll note, though, he has not gone after Sheldon Adelson. He has gone after the Koch brothers. And so I would be very surprised, as I think a lot of very informed folks in Nevada would be, if Sheldon Adelson went after Harry Reid in a big way in 2016.
You write about super donors who stand out as something of loose cannons, the people who say embarrassing things at times, are change their minds a lot, are unpredictable. Is that the new wave of political donors?
I think so. It's not that there weren't very wealthy people before who spouted off and said things. It's that before, because the giving was sort of limited and their ability to really shape an election was limited, you would have folks who were loose cannons who would kind of be cut off. They would be excluded from the political process, or at least they would not be able to get these audiences with top officials. Now, because their political giving power is so great, these public officials cannot afford to say, well, so-and-so said something that's really embarrassing and maybe something that's even anathema to my own ideology. I'm going to cut them off. They have to kind of grin and bear it and keep coming back to the trail.
Or hope that they own a basketball team and can be punished in other ways.
You know, it's actually a great analogy, and one that I reference in the book, this idea that some of these folks are sort of to politics what team owners are to sports. These are folks who have been wildly successful in whatever their chosen field or whatever the field that they fell into has accumulated great wealth, and we're sort of looking for something else to spend it on. And once you've bought all the vacation homes and yachts and other things that you may put your name on, hospital wings, if you're a sports junkie, maybe you plunk down a couple $100 million for the LA Clippers. If you're a political junkie, maybe you try to get Rick Santorum elected president because he's your buddy.
Well, $2 billion for the L.A. Clippers, a team that has complained during lockouts that it loses money. So you really have to wonder what the value is there. But then again, the same might be true with plunking all that money down for Rick Santorum, who pretty much everybody agrees doesn't have a chance.
Right. It's ego, and it's also sort of this junkie's love of the game. You know, if you're a huge basketball fan and you're worth $20 billion, as Steve Ballmer is, maybe it's not that bad of an – it's not an investment at all. Maybe it's not that bad of an expenditure, because what else are you going to do? And the other – you know, I would extend the similarity even further when you have these folks who think that by virtue of their great success in the business world, whether it's through tech like Steve Ballmer or whether it's through oil like the Koch brothers or gambling like Sheldon Adelson, they think that they have this great expertise that should be applicable to other fields. And so they tell the coach what plays to call. They tell the GM who to draft. And likewise in politics, you have some of these big donors who are meddling in a very real way that they wouldn't have been able to before, shaping ads, shaping strategy, oftentimes, again, totally divorced from what works, what the voters want to hear, or what the political operatives would prefer to do with their money. But when you're writing that check and it goes into the eight digits, you kind of run the show.
My guest is Kenneth P. Vogel. His book, Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle and a Pimp on the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. It is published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, Mayor Bloomberg financed his own campaign. He's a billionaire who financed his own campaign. Is Do any of these people have political ambitions along those lines?
I think some of them do, and it's sort of a new area. Self-financing certainly is not, and we've seen mixed results from self-financing. Certainly Mayor Bloomberg won, but plenty of other people who spent a whole lot of money, Meg Whitman in California.
Arianna Huffington's ex-husband.
Good point. And so, you know, some of those folks had been donors before, but they hadn't been mega donors of the sort that is now newly legalized by the Supreme Court. I think we could see some examples of that. One that my colleagues at Politico recently wrote about was Linda McMahon, the twice failed Connecticut Senate candidate, who has become sort of a major donor in her own right. And there's a question, is she trying to use this to get back into politics, or is she just giving because she's given up on being an active participant herself and wants to fund candidates who she's sympathetic to from the sidelines? We don't know.
Well, you say here that the ultra-rich are hijacking American politics. Are they hijacking it on both sides of the political spectrum? Every time you mention the Koch brothers, people on the right mentioned George Soros.
Yeah, Soros is actually an interesting example because he tried this before the rules were sort of laid out in such a way that made it not necessarily easy to do, but facilitated it. He was the sort of original mega donor back in 2004 when he spent upwards of $35 million trying to elect John Kerry president, defeat George W. Bush. He was unsuccessful, as were a lot of Democratic donors who spent big then. They kind of retreated to the sidelines, both because it was ineffective and because there was a crackdown by the Federal Election Commission and even some snooping around by the IRS on their giving to investigate whether it, in fact, was consistent with or violated campaign finance rules. Well, now those rules are out the window, and you could give as much as you want. Democrats have been slow to return to the fray. I think they are starting to, and I think we'll really see it in 2016 when there is a vacancy at the head of the party and a real debate about in which direction the party should head. This is where these mega donors in this new political environment have real power to shape the party's direction and to shape the candidates at the top of the ticket.
Well, President Obama appealed for small donations in 2008. Did anybody really believe that the landscape of finance might change? I mean, after all, in the last election, he raised slightly more than Mitt Romney, but both of them got around $1 billion. I can't imagine that that all of President Obama's money came from $50 contributions.
It definitely didn't. In 2008, you are right, though, that there was the prospect, because of his ability to raise these small donations in really historic sums utilizing new technology, that there might be a shift in the balance of power from these large donors and from some of the party committees even to small donors. However, the Supreme Court's decision intervened, and in 2012, we saw Barack Obama, who very much embraced, not just in 2008, but for really from the very beginning of his political career, he was a crusader against the role of big money in politics. And it's so telling that in 2012, he, if not abandoned, at least sort of turned a blind eye to those those motivations and really embraced this big money culture that had risen up since 2010.
Well, he would have said, "I had no choice, I had no option."
And in fact, he did say that. The words he used, which we quote in this book, in a private fundraiser with Bill Gates, the aforementioned Steve Ballmer, and some others in the Pacific Northwest, was that I cannot unilaterally disarm, and so I am forced by virtue of what Mitt Romney and the Koch brothers, who he name-checked there as well, are doing, to participate in this. And that's sort of reality. However, there are certainly folks who saw in him a champion for real political reform who were gravely disappointed.
The Center for Responsive Politics estimates the total cost of the 2012 presidential and congressional races at almost $6.3 billion. Do you have an estimate of how much of that money can be attributed to the ultra-rich donors?
Well, one of the things that we did was look at the money that was going into these outside groups, because those are disproportionately funded by wealthy donors. And we found that $2.5 billion, which is in a number that's used in the subhead of the book, was spent by these outside groups. And what's really notable about that is it's the first time since we've been keeping close track of these things that the number, that the amount raised and spent by these outside groups exceeded that spent by the party committees, which is $1.6 billion. So that really shows the migration of money and power from the parties and the candidates to these big donors and their outside groups.
So the parties no longer can set the agenda completely. In fact, it's the outside groups who are often coming up with the campaign strategies.
And more than the campaign strategies, even the governing strategies. And we saw this most acutely with the government shutdown last year, where John Boehner, with all the trappings of power that the Republican Party apparatus should offer him, was unable to whip the votes of these Tea Party members of his own caucus because they were, in fact, more reliant on and more frightened by these outside groups and the spending that they could do to defeat or help them in the subsequent election.
Well, the Tea Party candidates haven't been doing as well in the current primaries. Does that mean that it was just a fad?
I would say just the opposite.
Or that things changed?
In fact, that it shows that the establishment groups have embraced this type of outside spending, and so they are dwarfing the spending through these new means that the Tea Party groups have used so successfully in the past and tried to use again, and found that when, you know, two can play at that game. And so soon we'll have the potential of multiple factions, both within the Democratic Party or the liberal base and the Republican Party, sort of fighting it out for control of the soul of their respective parties or political movements.
We hear a lot about a few, like the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, George Soros. Are there any other major players who are off the radar?
Yeah, and they're increasingly becoming players in their own right, at least in the political world. And I think some of these folks will eventually, if they continue on the current pace, become household names. But on the left, you see folks like Amber and Steve Mostyn. They're Houston trial lawyers who gave upwards of $5 million in the 2012 cycle to support President Obama and Democratic candidates. They're playing a bigger role. Tom Steyer, the retired San Francisco hedge fund billionaire.
But he says it's all about the environment in his case.
It's true.
Is it about politics or is it about the environment?
I think it's, you could make the case for both, and certainly many have, including on the left, where some folks are uneasy with this spending, not just because they think that it's somehow anathema to small d democracy, but also because they think this guy is setting the agenda for the party, or is at least challenging the agenda of the party on some of these key issues that we would prefer to have nuance, and he's coming in with the hammer and either forcing us to respond to him or pay the consequences.
Well, do you think that President Obama has responded to him? Is that why we're suddenly hearing about a new focus on the environment?
A little bit, although it should be noted that he hasn't gotten his way with the key issue that really drew him into this, the Keystone XL pipeline, which he wanted rejected, still may very well be rejected, but he hasn't gotten the swift action from Democrats that he would like.
They're waiting until after the election to make a decision.
That's,
I wonder why.
Cynical view, but yes.
My guest is Kenneth P. Vogel. His book, Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle and a Pimp on the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. We will get to that suspicious vehicle and the pimp somewhere down the line. The book is published by Public Affairs. We'll be back right after this. We're back with Kenneth P. Vogel. His book, Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle and a Pimp on the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. It's published by Public Affairs. You quote Barack Obama saying that a handful of people could now decide an election. Does he mean that wealthy donors could effectively buy an election? And do the big donors think of themselves as buying elections?
Yes, I think he does think that that in fact a handful of donors could get together, and as he put it, and as we quote, at least by the nomination for a major party candidate for president, if not by the presidency itself. And we haven't seen that. I mean, we frankly have not seen that result yet because of some of the things I talked about, the way there is this backlash, the way these big donors tend to spend this money in sort of a ham-handed way that is either driven by ego or passion, but not necessarily cold logic. And so it certainly is possible. We've seen it in Senate races, I think, more than a presidential race. But we're just really at the start of this era.
Well, a recent documentary argues that Scott Walker was saved from being recalled as governor of Wisconsin because of all the money that poured into the state to aid his cause. It looked like he was going to lose, and then this very, very sophisticated ad campaign, and he wound up winning.
And more than that, there was really effective use of ground organizing by the right and by his supporters, which is something that we have not seen in the past. This is traditionally an area where the left has been dominant, thanks to union supporters and thanks to environmental groups that have been very effective at mobilizing voters. It's been a deficit for the right, and I think that this big money now allows them to compete with the left in a way that we hadn't seen before, and I think that really helps Scott Walker.
Well, Americans for Prosperity were major players there. What kind of organization is that?
This is the group that is primarily funded by the Koch brothers and the Koch brothers donors. When we talk about the Koch brothers, it's important to note that while they are spectacularly wealthy, if you combine their wealth, they'd be the richest person in the United States. Their real power comes from the ability to mobilize and channel massive donations from a vast network of other wealthy donors. And so one of the places where they've been channeling it is to Americans for Prosperity. And it is really the center of gravity for the right right now. It's going to spend $125 million in these midterm elections, which is more than any of the congressional arms of either of the two major party committees spent in the last midterm elections.
And do they have specific goals?
Yeah, they are.
I mean, in the case of Scott Walker was hurting the public unions. Anything else there?
The interesting thing about the Koch brothers operation more broadly, as well as Americans for Prosperity specifically, is that they say that they're issue driven and they're not about candidates. And so their issues do include things like fighting public sector union bargaining power and fighting environmental regulations and, you know, fighting minimum wage increases. And these are things that all could redound to the benefit of the Koch brothers and of the donors in their network, the financial, personal financial benefit. But if you look at their ads, they never come right out and say, elect Scott Walker, defeat Barack Obama. Actually, the Barack Obama is one exception where they did actually go that extra line. But they pride themselves on being issue-based and nonpartisan. And if you look at their ads, they clearly communicate nonetheless that they want the Democrat to lose and the Republican to win. But their tax status prohibits them from spending a majority of their funds on that. So they play this game and do this dance where they say, call Barack Obama and ask him why he hates babies and puppies.
Now, you mentioned that they have meetings with other very wealthy people. They have one every year.
They have two every year.
And that's where they get them to commit to supporting the causes like Americans for Prosperity and some of the other things that they are also supporting. How is that different from what Karl Rove does?
Well, They're more successful at it, frankly. Karl Rove has tried. One of the things that we write about in the book is that he, too, held a seminar in April of in October of 2013, where he tried to bring together all these wealthy donors to get them to give huge checks into his political operation. And he didn't get the same caliber of donors as the Koch brothers get. And so they have something that's somewhat unique. We do see a little bit of an analog on the left with the Democracy Alliance, which is the group that came out of the Soros and Peter Lewis funded 2004 effort to defeat George W. Bush. They, too, get together twice a year under strict secrecy and have presentations from politicians and from operatives who want their money and want to use it and organize it in such a way that it will help them and help their cause, not just in terms of at the ballot box in the next election, but shaping the priorities of the Democratic Party.
Are the political strategists and networkers who pull together all the donors and figure out ways to keep it legal the real leaders in the growth of big money these days?
I would have said that in 2010 and 2012 because they were so aggressive in moving into this new area of spending. What we've seen, though, since 2012, particularly on the right, where the major donors were so disappointed because they spent such unprecedented sums trying to defeat Barack Obama, $1 billion just combining the Koch brothers operations, Karl Rove's, and a few other groups, and had nothing to show for it. And so we've seen some of these donors band together and sort of form their own individual donor factions where they their goal is to exert more control over how their money is spent. And it's conceivable that we could have sort of these warring factions of tribes, if you will, of like major donors who are competing within the Republican and Democratic parties.
Are they all concerned with keeping it strictly legal?
I think most of them are. When you get to that high level where someone has the ability to write a seven-figure check, they also have the ability to have lawyers around them who are urging caution and dotting every I and crossing every T.
Well, NPR reported that New York State, and I'm quoting, is notorious for not regulating campaign finance too stringently. Are we all that different from other states in the union or the federal government? Another example, former New York State Senator Seymour Lachman said about New York, it's a culture of corruption. It's very sad that you have at this point in New York State, the Empire State, more corrupt officials than any other state. I'm assuming that has to do with the influence of big money on our public officials here.
Yeah, and it's very hard to get the political and the public will for reform on these issues. You know, even when you have the laws in place and the regulations in place that would allow enforcement, some of the agencies are sort of set up, the watchdogs are sort of set up to gridlock or at least to not be aggressive in their pursuit of violations and enforcement of the rules. And so you really need a major scandal. You mentioned 1907 and Teddy Roosevelt and the Tillman Act. Well, that was the result of major scandals in the preceding two presidential elections. Watergate, obviously, that's when the Federal Election Commission was created around that period. And it was because of this rising public enmity towards politics and towards the way that big money and money affected politics. And so, you know, the most recent time that we saw a real impetus for reform was after the Jack Abramoff scandal. We saw the passage of it in 2007 of a lobbying reform bill. What's interesting is you talk to these reformers and the folks who want to see the laws tighten. They're almost praying for a scandal. They want to see this big money buy a presidency and then later be revealed to have been illegal or unethical or someone to have gotten something out of it so that they can get the public and political will to change the laws.
Well, McCain-Feingold was a bipartisan effort at campaign reform, passed just 12 years ago, doesn't seem to have had much of an impact.
Yeah, I mean, it's also another one that was the result of scandal, the Enron scandal, Enron WorldCom scandals, and then, frankly, the Clinton campaign finance scandals. But you're right, they passed it, and we have a court now, a Supreme Court, that the majority is anti-regulation. They see these regulations as an infringement upon free speech, and so they have systematically whittled away at that McCain-Feingold Act. And frankly, you look at some of the cases that are coming through the court system right now, and there's a possibility they could go beyond the four corners of McCain-Feingold and striking down other regulations.
I was going to ask you about the fact that Justices Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia have argued that any expenditure is protected speech and wondered whether we could see an abolition of all limits on campaign spending in the near future.
That's certainly the goal of some of these anti-regulation folks. Another area where I think that there is potentially some momentum or where folks hope that there is momentum to strike down rules is in disclosure. I mean, we talked about how now it's possible for some super PAC donations to be revealed and to be known. There are folks who argue that the potential for retribution for having your name disclosed as being a major donor to a campaign or to a cause or a candidate.
Against same-sex marriage, for example. That became a big issue in California.
That's the example that they all cite, where a number of the businesses that donated to the pro-Proposition 8, so the anti-gay marriage side of things, found themselves the subject of boycotts. And they said, how can this be free speech if when we give this money to advocate for the cause that we believe in, we are penalized or we face some kind of public retribution? And so there have been efforts to strike down disclosure laws as unconstitutional infringement upon free speech. So far, they've been upheld.
In his book, This Town, Mark Leibovich wrote that getting rich has become the great bipartisan ideal in Washington. You still hear the term public service, he writes, but often with irony and full knowledge that self-sacrifice is now the real insider play. And a lot of these guys are getting rich because they're getting stock tips. I guess people in Congress are protected, or at least were protected, from insider trading rules that the rest of us are not. Isn't that another way to influence our politicians?
Yeah, I think so. And certainly you see the one thing that you are able to trace, and with all this stuff, it's becoming increasingly difficult to actually follow the money. But the one place where you are able to follow the money that I found very interesting is from these donors' pockets to these super PACs to some of these consultants who really cashed in after 2012. We crunched the numbers and reported in the book that just the five highest grossing political consulting firms in the 2012 election cycle cleared $1.3 billion in payments to them. And you drive around Washington, D.C., and you cross match those FEC records with property records, and you'll suddenly find a lot of consultants who are buying new homes in the Washington, D.C. suburbs right after election cycles.
In January, the Center for Responsive Politics reported that now more than half of the members of the House and Senate are millionaires, the first time in American history. I do want to get to the pimp and the suspicious vehicle, but you call Richard Nixon's 1972 election the first modern presidential campaign. A lot of campaigns have been called that, JFK, Nixon in 60, Harrison in 1840. Why Nixon in 72?
It was the techniques. It was both the amount of money that was raised, which was then historic and now was sort of laughable, but it was the techniques. It was the really television focus, the incredible expenditures on television ads, as well as the direct mailings. And frankly, it was really the dawn of micro-targeting, where he was using what we think of now as sort of low-level data to figure out sort of where the odds were and where the persuadable voters were, in a way that I think presaged some of the stuff that we see today.
And we wound up with the Southern Strategy.
Right, yeah. And that was sort of a cynical play, but it was effective for him at least.
Okay, in a minute and a half, the two things that are meant to lure readers in your subtitle, One Suspicious Vehicle and a Pimp.
The suspicious vehicle is my own rental car that I drove to go try to crash the Koch brothers' April 2013 donor seminar. They typically have very tight security around these things. I was able to get into this particular seminar. When they found me out, they escorted me, the hotel security and Koch security, out to my rental car. Wrote down the number of the rental car and reported it as suspicious to the Riverside County Sheriff, which then tracked me down and asked me what I was doing on the property and whether there was some kind of issue. And I explained to them that, no, as a reporter trying to cover this thing, it's private property, so they could kick whoever they want out. I was one of the folks that they kicked out.
But that was their way of getting back at you, actually reporting it to the sheriff.
I don't want to speculate on the motivations, but it certainly seemed to be past the point where they were worried about me being on the property, and sort of a little bit of payback maybe. And then the pimp is a security guard on the other side who was doing security for the Democratic Governors Association at a major donor fundraiser that attracted about a dozen governors to a mansion in the outskirts of Charlotte, North Carolina, on the sidelines of the Democratic National Convention in 2012. Again, I was found out, kicked out by the security guard who defended the right of these folks to congregate and to raise money, and suggested that I was somehow posing a security threat. He was a former police officer who was kicked off the police force in a nearby North Carolina town for running a prostitution ring out of his patrol car.
So is that a good job for a former pimp or a pimp?
I would think that security around these major donor fundraisers might be a growing area, yes.
Kenneth P. Vogel covers the confluence of money, politics, and influence for Politico. So did this grow out of your reporting at Politico?
Yeah, I saw a lot of first of all, we covered the big money both before the Supreme Court decision, then after the Supreme Court decision, and saw this as a major change in politics. But more than that, there was sort of an easy and oversimplified presentation and perspective that I think a lot of folks had, that these big donors were these evil geniuses behind the curtain who were manipulating politics to their will and to help their bottom line. And it turns out that a lot of them were kind of ham-handed and clueless, and they have had a huge effect on politics. It's just not necessarily the one that they intended.
Kenneth P. Vogel's book is called Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and a Pimp on the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. It's published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It was a pleasure coming in.